This is Tim, and this is the 100th episode of Deconstructing Comics. Welcome to Deconstructing Comics, episode 100, sponsored by ComicsNow.com. Today we have a special treat, an interview with Phil Dunlap, creator of the syndicated comic strip Inkpen. In this interview we talk about Dunlap's inspirations for Inkpen, how he got the comic into syndication, his process for producing the strip, and much more. First off, I asked him how many newspapers are currently carrying Inkpen.
It's around 46.
Okay.
So they tend to sort of round up.
Yeah.
You know,
sure. Okay.
Is, you know, industry practice, but industry standard. Mm-hmm. Okay. But yeah, I mean, since it debuted, I've picked up a handful and sort of lost a handful. I think I'm generally up. Mm-hmm. From I'm definitely up from when I started, but you launch with a certain, they go out and they sell it for a couple of months before the launch date.
Mm-hmm.
So you get a chunk, and then, you know, the theory is that you kind of keep picking up papers as you go, which you do, and then, you know, eventually you lose one, and then sort of have a breakdown.
Yeah. So had you had anything else published before Inkpen, published anywhere?
You know, I had a strip called Living Joke that had run. I was doing it as something to run in alternative weeklies.
Mm-hmm.
That was back in like 94 or 95.
Mm-hmm.
And that had run a couple times in the Funny Times, which is I think it's a monthly newspaper that you can find in newspaper boxes sometimes, and they mm-hmm. have subscription service. And then it ran in a couple of small papers, but it never really caught on. Didn't really pick up on the whole alternative weekly vibe that much.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the only thing I had really hadn't gotten in print before.
So, what was your inspiration for Inkpen?
Well, I've been temping to make a living, and so basically, you know, I've been working with strip. I've been trying to do comics. I've been trying to do animation, and I really didn't have, really didn't find that I had the sort of work ethic to do that much work, to do, you know, 20 pages or 25 pages a month,
mm-hmm.
or to draw thousands of drawings or, you know, any of that sort of stuff. It exhausted me just thinking about it. So I tried focusing on the sort of shorter form comic strip idea. And of course, I went to the weekly one immediately first because it was less work. and that didn't, you know, it didn't really work out. And so I started thinking about doing a daily strip, and I actually hadn't read the comics page in years because I lived in New York and was reading the New York Times. So,
mm-hmm.
You know, I read comic books, and that was about it. But I grew up reading, you know, Peanuts and
mm-hmm.
Bloom County, especially, was probably my favorite.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, Calvin and Hobbes and Far Side and all those, you know, great classics. And then everything else in between. Shoe, actually, I don't know if you know that strip. It's still around, but
oh, yeah.
Jeff McNally he passed on, so he doesn't draw it anymore. But
mm-hmm.
the early days of Shoe were actually, as I recall, when I was 12, whatever, being very funny.
Mm-hmm.
And it was actually an inspiration, too, because it was sort of an office environment and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But the dynamic of Bloom County, I always really reacted to. It was, you know, a lot of characters, a lot of, like the rhythm of it, a lot of, you know, energy and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So So I was trying to come up with an idea for, you know, in my mind, comic strips were funny animals. Garfield was I was really into Garfield when I was 10. You know, it was a Snoopy, Garfield, Opus, Cal Hobbs. Mm-hmm. So I decided, I was trying to think of a way to get funny animals in an environment together, you know, that sort of made sense.
Mm-hmm.
And I was actually, so I was sitting at work and I was, you know, filling out my timesheet and I was like, well, you know, what if it was an employment agency for different animals? And I was like, well, you know, that's wear out pretty thin, you know, getting whatever, farm jobs and pet jobs and stuff like that. And then I just took it a step back and I was like, well, what if instead of being, you know, animals who are cartoon drawings of animals, they are actually cartoon characters of animals, and they could do whatever. They could be getting jobs in comic strips or getting jobs in animation or you know,
advertisements,
serial mascots, that sort of stuff. And then, so that I kind of, you know, I think it even evolved over an hour. I was just sort of thinking about it, and all this stuff sort of rolling around in my head.
Mm-hmm.
And the characters kind of just appeared to me, strangely. The Bixby, who's the rat, who's the main agent, he just appeared, and he seemed to be the perfect, you know, agent to carry this out. And all the other characters actually began as one-off jokes. You know, the rabbit was just supposed to be, you know, the Trix rabbit. He was a serial mascot.
Mm-hmm.
The pig was just, you know, a joke about him being in a sandwich. The superhero was just meant to be, you know, again, they were all just supposed to be one-off jokes.
Mm-hmm.
And I started showing them to my friends, and my wife loves Ham Hock. She's like, you gotta keep using it. And I was thinking to myself, what am I gonna, you know, I can't keep telling jokes about him being lunch meat and stuff like that. So, but it was a good idea because, you know, eventually when I got it to Universal Press, he, you know, my editor told me you got to limit the number of characters. You got to get it down because as I was developing the strip, anytime I ran out of ideas, I just came up with a new character.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I was just like, oh, I can do Tarzan. I can do a Mary Worth spoof. I can do, you know, whatever. And so he's like, you gotta knock that off. You gotta have characters that people can actually relate to and who they remember their names and they see them over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, it's interesting to me that you have characters from different genres who are, you know, superhero and funny animal who are, you know, coming into the agency to get work.
Right. Well, that was, I mean, as soon as I kind of hit on the idea, I realized I could, you know, I mean, that was the other thing about this idea. That I subconsciously must have designed it so that I couldn't, you know, I didn't paint myself into a corner.
Mm-hmm.
I was really nervous about having it be, you know, like Garfield. Something like Garfield would terrify me. So there's a cat sitting on a kitchen counter, I guess, you know, thinking it can't even communicate with anybody. I mean, the limitations that are put on that are mind-boggling, and it's been going for, you know, 20-odd years now.
Mm-hmm.
But that, to me, I mean, that's something, you know, I gravitate more to Bloom County, where, you know, there's this world where you've got talking animals, you've got, you know, political spoofs, you've got actual people, you know, actual celebrities and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So something like that, much more open-ended. So I think that's sort of where my mind was working. And then, of course, you know, the idea of the temp agency and having to go to different jobs and dealing with the humiliation of, you know, just having to do this menial stuff. And you know, a big part of the sort of creative energy of the strip really came from the frustration of, you know, feeling like, you know, I have something to do. I want to do something. Whether it's a comic book or animation or a comic strip or whatever, and then having to go to an office and, you know, move files around and stuff.
It's
very frustrating. And so that was sort of the strip is like, well, now I can put that frustration off onto other characters, have them be humiliated, and, you know, and hopefully someone will laugh at it because it makes me cry.
So how did you get it into Universal Press then? How does that process work?
Well, for me, I had actually just, I'd been kind of ran out of steam in New York, and I moved to Los Angeles. I didn't have any work. I couldn't find a job for a while, so I sat in my apartment and I just drew, which was fantastic, you know, and that's sort of the way it should be for artists, is to just have the space to, you know, draw. But anyway, I was able to come up with a bunch of strips, a bunch of ideas, and then I just looked online, and there's I think there's about four or five major syndicates, and they have their, they all pretty much have the same criteria, which is 6 weeks of strips, of and then like four Sundays.
Yeah.
And so it was very easy. I didn't have to go through the phone book and you know, sift through a bunch of stuff. There was four places to send it. I got four envelopes. I printed it out and mailed it off. And two of them actually got back to me, and Universal Press was the the bigger and you know, shinier one. So I decided to go with them. And that was basically, I mean, very, it was the first time I'd submitted to a syndicate, so it seemed easy, but, you know, I'm sure it's very difficult to do. I actually looked in the Graphic Artists Guild handbook, and I was, after the fact, and I was looking up all the statistics and, you know, the number of submissions they get as opposed to how many they can sign, and the chances of making it you know, out of 5 years and stuff is pretty staggering. So I appreciate it a lot more after I learned that. But it ended up, you know, it still was in development for 2 years because they can't, you know, the market is so weird for newspaper strips that they can only launch a handful of strips every year. So...
Well, and it's still so clogged up with old strips that are, you know, their creators are dead and they're still just kind of lumbering
on.
Yeah,
exactly. And then, of course, newspapers, you know, are going out of business left and right. So you lose a lot that way, too. So, yeah, and, you know, not having read comic strips in a long time, I didn't know anything about the industry. I didn't know anything about what was on the comics page. You know, so I was, again, I was thinking... Funny Animals, that's what comic strips are. And then I was in L.A. and I got a subscription to the L.A. Times, and I was reading it, and I was like, you know, where are the funny animals? It was all family strips, and I was stunned. I was, like, flabbergasted that there were still all these old strips. There was all the soap opera strips, you know, Blondie and Wizard of Id and all these strips that I read as a kid. I just figured they were, you know, they were gone. And I was stunned, you know. And that's not to say, you know, it's not to say whatever that they're, that's good or bad, but it was, I mean, obviously in some cases it's bad, in some cases it's good. And it's good for the newspapers because they still make money off of, I mean, they still, they get readers for those strips. So that, I mean, that was interesting to me because I'd create, you know, this, my whole idea was predicated on a completely different market, you know, and I think it was largely because, you know, most of what I was exposed to or have been exposing myself to is, you know, cartoons on, you know, Saturday morning cartoons, Nickelodeon, because I was trying to get into that industry, and comic books. So, you know, the big influence of my strip is clearly more along those lines than actually what's on the comics page. But I find that when I do a reference to a comic strip, you know, that's when I sort of get people respond to that, you know. So...
Okay.
I kind of got to, you know, I have to sort of, I've been trying to learn to sort of direct it more towards the actual audience and not just do whatever it is I want to do.
So, as I mentioned to you before, our podcast is aimed at people who are, you know, trying to get started in comics, and so I imagine that many of them are wondering, can you actually make a living doing this? And can you quit your day job?
Well, I haven't been able to quit my day job yet, and a lot of the artists I know haven't been able to quit their day job. But I know there are people who do make a living off of it. I think it's becoming increasingly difficult to do that. And, you know, unfortunately, as I was saying, because of the market, I think the prospects are getting slimmer and slimmer every year. You know, I mean, the fact that the newspaper readership is obviously getting older. Kids, just younger people, aren't picking up the newspaper. The news, and that's, you know, that's killing the industry. The readership is getting older. So, you know, the editors obviously are in a bind because they'd want to put newer strips in there that get younger people reading the newspapers. But then, if they upset their older readership, then they're going to lose, and they don't want to lose readers.
Yeah.
And obviously, you know, newspaper circulation isn't based solely on the comics page, but, you know, it's a part of it, but unfortunately it's becoming a smaller and smaller part of it, which is, of course, bad for the comics. So. But, you know, a lot of artists I know started out as freelance illustrators. And so then they picked up, you know, then they got their strip syndicated, and so they've been able to do that as a side job to supplement, you know, another already artistic career. So unfortunately, I wasn't in that space when I got the strip, and I haven't been able to extricate myself from my day job yet. So I'm still toiling away 9 to 5, but I mean, that would sort of be the goal. But I think it's sort of a rare cartoonist who these days who can get the strip that will, you know, make them a ton of money.
Yeah. Well, and I was wondering too, why, or if you'd considered it, but why you chose to go with a newspaper strip rather than, like, going straight to online and publishing it on the web?
Honestly, because it didn't really occur to me. Maybe it's just because, you know, how I grew up and how, you know, what I was exposed to when I was younger, but I just sort of, I'm still of the mindset that, you know, print is something more solid, something has more cachet, you know. And honestly, the other thing, you know, I'm a really terrible businessman. I have no mind for any of that sort of stuff. So
yeah, no, neither am I.
Being able to, well, at least you have, you know, I don't even have a blog. Like, I can't even get myself together to do that, you know. So to do that as sort of a small business type of mindset, I mean, that was something that I also just didn't even really want to deal with. I suppose if I hadn't gotten picked up by a syndicate and I really wanted to do the strip, that would be my next logical step. You know, and sometimes I think that, you know, I can't really say that, but the comments that I read, I get more comments online than I do get, you know, written into the syndicate or written into the newspapers that I see. And from what I can gather, the comments that I get online are from people who read it online. You know, and all this stuff is online now.
Yeah.
You know,
that's where I read it.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So, you know, and I don't even read a paper. Again, I'm back in New York now, so I read the New York Times again, and I didn't read a paper with, you know, the comics page.
Yeah.
Every now and then I'll find, you know, find a post on the subway and read the comics. But, you know, I get like two different comic subscriptions, and I get them emailed to me, and then, you know, now since I've gotten into this, I've been finding, you know, different online comics and so forth. But
mm-hmm.
I really didn't, at the time that I conceived the strip and submitted it to the syndicate, I didn't really know that sort of stuff even really existed, or that it was more than just, you know, a couple of people putting something up on their own website.
Yeah, I mean, I was publishing on my own webcomic for a while. I haven't had time to work on it lately, but just trying to figure out how to get people to find it is a challenge.
Right. Yeah, exactly. You know, and I found out after the fact about strips like, you know, PvP and mm-hmm. Beetle Sweeties
mm-hmm.
and Short Pact and that sort of stuff. But I found out about those by, you know, reading articles either in print or online or, you know, message boards where someone mentions my strip and I go to the message board and I see what they're saying about my strip, and then, you know, another link is, oh, you know, this strip, and then, you know, I find a lot of stuff that way. But, you know, for me, too, I don't really have a lot of time to go and seek this stuff out.
Yeah, well, you got to draw a strip every day plus your 9-to-5, so
right, yeah.
Not much time.
Yeah.
So I wanted to ask you about your process for drawing the strip. Are you drawing something just on paper, or doing any part of it in the computer, or how do you do that?
I draw everything on paper. I pencil it. I pencil it with blue pencil. Blue mechanical pencil
mm-hmm.
lead, and then I ink it, and then I scan it in, and in Photoshop,
mm-hmm.
Just basically select the channel and get rid of the blue,
mm.
which is really easy. It's much easier than you know, the old days. When I was in high school, I learned how to do all this, you know, a lot of this stuff. You know, you draw in blue pencil and then take a photostat of it, which is gigantic camera, you know, and it would basically expose it so that the blue wouldn't show up.
Mm-hmm.
But Photoshop is so much easier now. But so I scan every drawing in individually, and then I lay it out in Quark Express, actually.
Mm.
That's actually what I do for my day job. I do essentially desktop publishing.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a font. I have a template for the strips. And it's great because, I mean, I don't even know how people draw strips the old way, and people still do this, where, you know, they actually, it'll be all four panels or three panels or whatever will just be on the same piece of paper, all the lettering, you know, everything's, it's all one piece of artwork,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
and I used to, you know, when I was trying to draw comics, I used to do it that way, and I guess I did my old strip that way. I'm just, it was really hard. It was really hard not to make a mistake, you know.
Mm.
And if you make a mistake, you gotta, you know, the whole thing could possibly ruin. So now I do it all compartmentalized. I have like a whole sort of assembly line,
mm-hmm.
And I drop each drawing in individually into a panel, and then I put the artwork in there. If I need to change something, I'll open the image back up in Photoshop and erase something, or clean up the art, or take an image from one panel and put it in another. So I try to leave my options open that way too. So nothing, you know, everything I can sort of manipulate everything if I want to.
Mm-hmm.
And then for the Sundays, I color them all in Photoshop too.
I see. Now, a lot of the dailies show up in color, like in some papers or on the internet. Is the syndicate doing that coloring, or how? Where does that come
yeah.
from?
Yeah. Yeah. The syndicate does that. I think for free. I might be paying for it. I'm not sure. again, I'm not the businessman. I don't really read my my statements that closely. But yeah, they started when I first started running it online. It wasn't in color, and then they went back and colored it. And some guys don't. I don't know if you've ever seen Lucky Cow.
No.
That was one that's been around for a while before I started, but you know, I discovered it on Universal Press's site, and that's been in black and white for as long as I've seen it. And I think for like a week it was in color, the daily. And he must have submitted, you know, he must have said, all right, I'll do it in color, and then decided that he just didn't like it and asked him not to, you know.
Mm.
But because I think that, you know, the conventional wisdom is that people like to prefer to see it in color.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the newspapers, I've gotten newspapers from Detroit and one from South Carolina, and they color them themselves.
Wow.
Which, I mean, it's kind of mind-boggling that they do all the... I think even in Chicago they do the dailies, or at least one page of dailies in color, I'm not sure. But... yeah, I mean, they have someone on their staff who colors them, you know, every strip themselves.
Mm.
And it was funny because they colored one of the characters completely wrong.
Mm.
It didn't look bad, but I was like, you know, it's good. They just kind of made it up as they went along.
Yeah, well, and sometimes, too, it's been pointed out that, like, a person's hair color might change from day to day.
Right, yeah. They were I guess they were talking about that on... Comics Curmudgeon.
Right, exactly.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, whatever it was. Apartment 3G. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's sort of... I mean, that's happened on my strip where, you know, they've gotten stuff wrong or you know, they've colored things, whatever, too darkly, or they've didn't get, like, a special effect that I was using, a lighting effect, or, you know, some sort of blast or explosion or whatever, and you know, I've had to email them and very gingerly ask them to redo it because, you know, they're kind of doing me a favor by doing this. Again, I might be paying them, so I might be involved. But yeah, I mean, it's sort of like, you know, you sort of have to let it go a little bit because I couldn't possibly color all of that myself.
Mm.
But you know, sometimes I've friends have gotten me newspapers and I've seen them in black and white and. You know, especially in a newspaper, it's so crisp. It's really nice to see it in black and white because that's sort of the way it's intended to be.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, I mean, if the audience prefers it in color, then
yeah.
I think you sort of have to let that go.
I intended to go back and read the whole 2 years of Inkpen before this, but I didn't quite make it. But, I have a subscription to my comics page site.
Right.
So, but I noticed, well, the characters at the beginning all look pretty much the same, except Ralston seems to have kind of changed.
Yeah.
His ears were just kind of more square at the beginning.
Yeah. It's funny because I just recently went back, and I do that every now and then. I'll go back and read it all over, just, you know,
mm-hmm.
just remind myself what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And honestly, I mean, when I get to those early strips, I'm kind of embarrassed about how bad about it looks in comparison, because, you know, I noticed that from way back reading comics, you know, poring over these books, I would read Boone County books over and over again, Peanuts books over and over again, and mm-hmm. I always noticed how different they looked.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, sure. Opus changed so much from the beginning.
Oh, yeah, totally. and even Garfield. I mean, Garfield mm-hmm. was almost completely different at the beginning. Mm-hmm. Of course, he doesn't draw that anymore, so you know, that sort of could explain his metamorphosis. But, you know, even Calvin and Hobbes, if you look at the earlier strips and the artwork's different, and, you know, the funny thing is when I started this strip, I felt like I was a pretty accomplished artist. I've been drawing for a long time, and you know,
mm-hmm.
just studying and producing stuff and trying to get better. And And when I, you know, when I started this, I really felt like I'm at the top of my game, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And after doing the strip for 2 years, you know, I realized how much I've learned and how much better I've gotten from doing this. And for someone, you know, who's trying to come up with sort of something that I could put the least amount of effort into, it's been, it's ended up being a lot of work.
Mm-hmm.
But that work is the most, like, amazing school you could possibly go to, because you're just producing, having to produce it every week, just forcing yourself to draw these characters over and over again. And I'm constantly trying to figure out, you know, I'll draw something and then I'll see it and I'll decide that I don't like the way, like Ralston's ears, for example, I decided that they didn't have a lot of life to them or whatever it was. But seeing it over and over again, you know, I decided that aesthetically it just wasn't that great. Or I just from the repetition of drawing, I just wanted to draw it a different way, you know, or I wanted to, you know, sometimes you make a mistake and you're like, oh my God, it looks so much better, you know. So. Yeah, I mean the characters. I mean they've all evolved actually a lot. I mean, even Ham Hock too. I looked at the first drawing I ever did at Ham Hock, and I was like, oh my God, terrible. And you know, I mean, that's probably the best part of doing this. It's a grind a lot of the time, but you learn so much, and you're constantly. It also makes you look outside of what you're doing a lot, because I'm constantly trying to look for. I mean, one of the things is you're constantly trying to look for ideas. You know, you've got to come up with a joke a day, you know, or at least an idea a day or something. You know, you just want to. it's got to have a point to it somehow.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm constantly looking, and for my strip. I can draw from anywhere I want. You know, sometimes I'll try and do something from the news, or I'll try and do some sort of social commentary, or I can do office stuff. I can do relationship stuff a little bit. And then of course I can draw from any sort of artistic genre I want. So, you know, I'm constantly looking to these different media for inspiration. And so, you know, I read comic books, comic strips. I watch cartoons. I read children's books, I read like the New Yorker and look at the cartoons in there, the illustrations in there, and I'm constantly looking at this stuff and trying to pick out styles or ways of solving problems that I can use.
Yeah.
You know. And that's really, really important too, because you know you don't get into this to do something really stagnant. And just, you know, it is repetitive, and you just don't want to get repetitive. You want to definitely like keep doing something new or different or whatever.
Yeah, so trying to keep getting inspired from other places and help put more material into the mix.
Yeah, exactly.
So, how long is it once you've got an idea? How long does it take you to actually draw like one daily strip to draw and deliver it?
Well, I do them again in sort of assembly line. So I typically come up with my, you know, I come up with ideas sort of as I go along, and I jot them down. And then on Saturday and Sunday, I sit down and I draw out an entire week of dailies and my Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll pencil them all out first, usually on Saturday, and then on Sunday I'll ink them all in. And then, this is my schedule now, but I've got to, like, working right on deadline.
Mm.
So it's not something I recommend to anyone trying to start out, but I go in on Monday to work, and I'll scan it. I'll scan the artwork in, and then, my downtime, I'll lay out the Sunday strip and hopefully color it that day and hand it in, because it's due on Monday. They're all technically due on Monday, but dailies have more of a, you can do a much shorter lead time on the dailies. The Sundays have to be in 6 weeks in advance because of the color separating and so forth.
Yeah.
So do the Sunday strip on Monday, hand that in, and then I'll start in on the dailies, usually that night, and then, you know, throughout the week. And then try and, of course, hand them in as early as possible. But the drop-dead due date is Friday, and they'll run the following, like, 2 Mondays after that.
Mm-hmm. I see.
So that's essentially like a week, or a week and a couple of days.
Mm. Okay.
But I try to, for a while I was much further ahead on deadlines, but it's just so easy to fall down, so... My ideal is to be a month ahead.
Mm-hmm.
Because what happens a lot is I'm working on deadline. I get the stuff done and I hand it in. And a lot of times it ends up being different than how I had come up with the idea. Sometimes I'll come up with an idea and not really have a punchline, but I'm just decide I got to get I got to get it done.
Mm-hmm.
Got to get it out. So I just start drawing it and then. I scan it and I can't even remember what the joke was, much less if I had a punchline for it. So then I type in, it's one of the things about having, be able to type all the lettering in, it's because I can just go, I'll just come up with something and then try and remember what I had and then come up with a completely different punchline. I'll run it by my editor. He'll come up with a different punchline or different idea. He can send me off in a different direction. That's kind of fun. It's also a little scary because sometimes I'll just get to the due date and I'm just come up with something that just doesn't make any sense and I got to hand it in. I don't really have a choice. And then I'll see it 2 weeks later. It shows up in my email and I read it. And I'm like, what the hell is that? I can't believe someone read that. I'm so embarrassed. But that's why I'd like to have Sometimes you surprise myself. Sometimes I'll see it, and I'm like, I don't even remember writing that, I'm like, oh, that's pretty funny.
That was my stand-in who did that strip.
Yeah, exactly. You're kind of like, wow, that's good. but that's why, ideally, I'd like to be able to do all that, get it done, put it away for at least a week, and bring it back out and see it again like you don't even remember it, have a little perspective on it, and then... be able to tweak it again before you hand it in. Because I've definitely, been working on, getting a book together, and I'm definitely changing some of the strips before they go in a book. Because I've read them over. I'll see it in my email, or I'll go back and read them over, and I'll be like, oh, that would have been so much better if you had said this.
Mm.
Even like a little wording thing. So,
yeah, just the wording of it makes a big difference in how funny it is.
Yeah, definitely.
I noticed what I did get reread this past week, that one theme that kind of keeps coming up is like health and nutrition and junk food.
Right.
Like recently you had the storyline about the Cheetos Middle School, which I thought was pretty good.
Thanks.
So is that like an important issue for you, or?
I guess so. I mean, the funny thing is, I grew up obsessed with sugared cereals. Like I loved.
Mm-hmm.
My mom used to cut the Trix rabbit off of the box and make like a little doll for me. I loved sugared cereals, and we were only allowed to eat them in the summer. So I mean that. Probably helped me, definitely helped my health only being able to have 2 months of that stuff. But, and then in college, I sometimes would have Cap'n Crunch for dinner because couldn't get to the whatever, McDonald's. So, I've definitely had sort of this love-hate relationship with it, but when I started doing the strip, I started thinking about it. Yeah, you realize how manipulative really this whole industry really is.
Mm-hmm.
So, I decided I could take a few pot shots at it. And the funny thing is, I just learned recently that, well, I guess the Cheetos Middle School sort of addressed that you know, Kellogg's now, they're not advertising to kids anymore because of that. So I read that and I was sort of like, oh well, there goes that source of material, because, you know, in like a few years no one would even get it. They're like, what are you talking about? Kids don't even, you know, they don't have rabbits on cereal boxes.
Tigers.
Yeah, exactly. So, but yeah, I mean, it's a fun source of material. The original conception of that was the cereal was called Cracks.
Mm-hmm.
That he was the mascot for, and I just thought that was so, you know, clever. Like, oh, here's I'm likening sugared cereal to, you know, a horribly addictive drug. And it was one of my first papers with the Detroit Free Press, and I got a. They didn't start running the strip right away. They started, I think, a month after it launched. But I got an email from them saying that they weren't going to run those strips because of cultural sensitivity issues or local sensitivity issues.
Mm.
And I was like, oh, like some people don't think it's funny to make fun of these horrible drugs that have like ruined people's lives and, you know, inner cities. It's like, oh,
mm. Well, and so it could have had something to do too with proximity to Battle Creek, Michigan. Do you think? You know, Kellogg's.
I don't know. I think it had more to do with the
crack reference.
Being in Detroit, yeah, I think. Because I've made other, you know, I've made other, you know, serial references to in the strip and that didn't have overt drug references, and they haven't blocked at that. So I actually feel pretty bad. At first, I was like, "How dare they?" And then I was like, "Oh, that's true. That's kind of not that funny for these people." For some people, so I kind of felt bad about that.
Well, then Cracks had a name change, didn't it?
Right, they changed it to Action Jacks.
Yeah.
Well, I think I changed it to Crudge at one point, just to avoid the drug reference.
Mm.
But I didn't make a deal out of that. I think I just started referring to it as Crudge, and then they changed it to Action Jacks. Try and make it sound like it was healthy for you. So that was, of course, you know, within the strip.
And then, then another name change that you dealt with was Captain Victorious. I ran across... That was before I was reading it, but I ran across a reference to that, and then I saw it in the strip that he had been Captain Victory at first.
Yeah. That was really interesting. I came up with the name Captain Victory because I was just trying to come up with, you know, what I thought was a ludicrous superhero name.
Mm-hmm.
And I was developing the strip for years, so I'd known him as Captain Victory, and so the strip started running for, I don't know how long it had been running, maybe a month.
Mm-hmm.
And we get this email from Jack Kirby's daughter, Lisa Kirby, very politely informing us that, you know, her family has a trademark on the name Captain Victory because it was a comic book that Kirby had done in, I guess, the 80s.
Mm.
And I'd never even heard, you know, I'm actually a big fan of Jack Kirby. You know, I loved his New God stuff. I love his early Fantastic Four stuff. But I never heard, you know, I never heard of Captain Victory, so I... I didn't want to insult her by saying, you know, I never heard of your father did, but I guess they had come out with another, they'd reprinted it recently, or not that long before. They were planning on reprinting it, so I kind of didn't know what to do because when the strip first started, I actually had a lot of stuff in the can. That was all done, and it was all, you know, and all lettered, and, you know, his name is mentioned throughout because that was one of the things my editor said. He's like, you gotta mention their name so people reading it remember their name.
Yeah.
So I actually had just gone through and added all these references to Captain Victory, and I was like, well, what am I supposed to do now? And so my editor's like, well, You know, I mean, it kind of fits in the theme of the strip. This would be actually, you could address it. It'd be
yeah, because they're aware that they're comic strip characters.
Exactly. They live in a world where comic books exist. And I was like, oh, yeah, that's a great idea. I can totally do that. So we emailed Lisa Kirby back, and I, you know, I apologized profusely for inadvertently using her father's, you know, the name of her father's creation, and I proposed that as a solution because, you know, because the other thing was at any given time, you know, you've got 2 weeks of strips that have already gone to the, you know, gone to the newspapers.
Mm-hmm.
And he was those 2 weeks had Captain Victory in them, and so I apologized that we couldn't do anything about that. There was going to have to be 2 more weeks of me using the name. But then I proposed this solution, and she was very amenable to that, and so the strip, you know, they go through and try and figure out a new name for him. They mentioned Jack Kirby, and I was very complimentary to Kirby in the strip,
mm-hmm.
Which I thought was sort of the least I could do.
Yeah.
But yeah, it ended up being a kind of a funny thing, but I was really nervous at first. You know, they've got this comic legend on the bad side of like the god of comics. So.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, since having read, you know, tons of superhero comics myself, I've enjoyed how you sort of question a lot of the conventions or sort of follow them through or look at different implications like the superhero insurance and I had to make a note of one strip. This would be my, it wasn't a punchline and it still cracked me up when Captain Victory or Victorious said, "Negato, where are those mozzarella sticks, evildoer?" It was the first panel, but yeah, it cracked me up nonetheless. Okay, so what would now you're, I'm cracking you up with your own.
Yeah, I completely forgot about that. That's but I was remembering that he said that if he wanted to, what was it? If he wanted to.
Well, yeah, Scrappy Lad had asked Negato to kidnap him, or like said, "You kidnapped me, so now Captain Victory has to, or Victorious has to rescue me." And yeah, Negato said he'd be more likely to rescue mozzarella sticks.
Right. Right.
Okay, so what would your advice be for someone else who wanted to follow the same path as you and try to get a strip in the newspaper?
Well, the first thing I would say is learn a lot about the industry and the market, because that's something I didn't do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably something that I should have done. Because I think that, I mean, like Leo, for instance, is a good example of this. Are you familiar with that strip?
Leo? No, I don't think I've seen that.
Well, Leo is probably the most recent blockbuster strip that's come out. It came out, I think, about a year and a half ago, and it launched in a ton of papers. It made 100 papers within months. It's just been a real runaway success. And one of the things that he did was, and brilliantly, I'm not taking anything away from him. He seems to have sort of picked out all of these sort of time-honored conventions and subject matter and so forth and sort of merged them together into this sort of super strip. And so he came up with a pretty clever sort of gimmick, if you will, but it's a pantomime strip, so there's no real dialogue in the strip. So I mean, most of them don't have any wording at all. Sometimes there's labels and so forth, and you know, it's sort of a mix of Charles Adams and Edward Gorey and a lot of these sort of old time artists, and it's a very sort of macabre element to it. But it's about, you know, the hero is a young boy and he's got this wild imagination or just sort of wild life and so forth. And so it sort of hits, it kind of hits every convention, it hits every audience, and it's really, I'm not saying that he calculated it. I think, again, I think it's a pretty good idea to do, is to sort of find ways to access the people who are reading the strips. And he does a lot of comic strip reference, self-reference, like more than I do even. And he's come up with some stuff that I'm sort of kicking myself that I didn't come up with. The concept of my strip is that they're aware that they're in a they are in comic strips. But one of the things that I decided that I would never break the fourth wall. I would never have them ever realize that they're on a comics page, even though they're in other comic strips and in comic books and so forth. And that was sort of the one restriction I put on myself, because I just felt like it would sort of lose its focus, it would lose its gravity if I did that.
Mm-hmm.
But that's something that a lot of other artists, sort of Leo in particular, has had success doing. That's sort of the first thing I would recommend. And then the other thing is to just draw, like really. When I was, before I did the strip, I was drawing every day, but I was sketching and I was just doodling, and every now and then I'd finish something. But I would really recommend, setting deadlines for yourself, finishing something, and then, being prepared to just throw it away. But you really get better doing that. I know a lot of artists, friends who just they'll work on something and then they can't get it right, and then they redo it or they try and fix it, and especially when you're trying to develop something, and I recommend getting as finished as possible and then just being willing to let it go, and go to the next page, go to the next strip, go move on and keep going forward, because really. You really hone your skills that way. You learn a lot, and you just get better.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing would be to read, read comic strips, read online comic strips, read, comic books, watch cartoons. I've gotten a lot of great ideas, not just in jokes, but in terms of, how to stage something, how to like an attitude or a expression from afternoon cartoons, Nickelodeon, Disney Channel, stuff like that. Don't limit yourself to one genre. Read a lot of stuff, look at a lot of stuff. I had a lot of sort of formal fine arts training high school and in college, like oil paintings and charcoal drawings and drawing from life, and it's another one where you really learn a lot doing that, and so that's another way. You just want to look anywhere and everywhere for inspiration and ideas and how to draw things and solve problems.
Okay. Well, I guess I'll wrap this up. Wish you much success with the continuation of the strip.
And, thank you very much.
Yeah, and thanks for doing the interview.
Absolutely. I wish you success with your various endeavors. I was looking through your site. I really like it. And,
thank you.
Saw your I didn't find your comic, but I found your colleague's comics look really good.
My comic is the Crazing Spider Hag.
I didn't find a link to that one.
Oh, really? Well, it's right on the front page of globalcomics.net. There's a link, and there's a little picture there.
I'll have to go back again. I'm not the.
Okay. Yeah. It may be a little confusing because our podcast is called the Deconstructing Comics, and it's built into the Global Comics site. There should be a link to Spider-Hag from that page too, though.
All right. I'll go back. I'll go back and check it out.
Okay. Yeah, I've had a different thing going on. I'm doing two podcasts actually. I'm doing a comics podcast, and I'm also doing an English study podcast for here in Japan. And the English study podcast requires writing a script, and so that just eats up all my
Oh,
time.
really? Oh, good.
So, I don't have any time to try to do my comics anymore,
Oh, that's too bad.
but if I can't figure out a way to make money from that podcast, I think I might just go back to doing comics because I'm getting a little tired of all the energy I'm putting into the
Yeah,
English
I'll
study
bet.
one.
Well, it's
But
a great, I mean, I've been rooting around your site. It's a great, except for all the background noise some of the coffee shop conversations.
Yeah, we haven't had a good place to have good quiet place to record. So
Right.
because he and I live kind of far apart, so
Okay. But other than that, I mean, it's a pretty cool resource. Cool, a lot of cool info in there. So I'll definitely be checking it out.
okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So there you have it, the first Deconstructing Comics interview of a syndicated cartoonist. We'd like to hear what you thought of it, so please send your comments to podcast@globalcomics.net. Then be sure to visit our sponsor, comicsnow.com. Get up to 30% off everything in stock or join their subscription service and get 35% off with no minimum order. Many of the comics we review on this podcast are supplied by comicsnow.com. Comics Now also provides Eric's newsletter, featured on our site, globalcomics.net. A few weeks ago, we discussed a comic created by a listener named Vincent Morris. Part 2 of his comic, Kid Intense, is now available on globalcomics.net, so we hope you'll take a look at that as well. At Frapper.com, you can put a pin in our Frapper map, and we'd greatly appreciate it if you'd give us a review in iTunes, Podcast Alley, or Podcast Pickle. We'd also appreciate your financial support. I haven't had a good plate of caviar all week. But seriously, any donation you are kind enough to make will be invested back into development of the show. Send us a tip via PayPal from the link on the podcast page at globalcomics.net. And once again, the email address to submit your comic or send us any comments is podcast@globalcomics.net. Next week, a discussion of the latest big step in Mulele's comics career. Thanks for listening. This is Tim. See you next week on Deconstructing Comics.
Long, Superman. I'm taking a vacation. I'll miss your medication. It helped to ease the pain.